Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. Today on Route 51, a salute to our veterans on the national holiday that commemorates their service on Route 51.
Liberating strife. Who more than self? Their country love. But she's 49 times. What I'm singing about tonight. America. Sweet America, bring God back gold and fire, till our success be nobleness and
I'm Glenn Moberg of Route 51. On this Veterans Day, we have three guests today. Ken Mason of Wausau is a World War II vet who served in the 8th Air Force Heavy Bombardment Group out of England. Ken flew missions over Berlin and Munich and had a close call in which his plane was almost shot down. Ken later was stationed in Madison, where he served as Sergeant Major in the radio school at the Air Force Base. He later opened his own business in downtown Wausau, Mason and Sims Tire Service. Jim Moss of Rothschild is a Vietnam veteran who served in the 11th Light Infantry Brigade, AmeriCal Division, near the city of Duc Pho. He was there at the height of the Vietnam War in 1968 and 1969. In recent years, Jim has been active in the Libertarian Party of Wisconsin and ran for state representative in Wausau's 85th Assembly District in this year's election. And Greg Foy of Wausau is the vice chairman of the board of directors of the High Ground Veterans Memorial in Neillsville. He also served in Southeast Asia during the Vietnam War as an Air Force ground equipment technician for the Strategic Air Command in Thailand. Now, if you're a veteran or you know one, if you've got family members or someone close to you who served, we want to hear your personal tribute on this Veterans Day or your story. Please give us a call and share your story toll-free at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Ken Mason, Jim Moss, Greg Foy, thanks so much for being with us today. And I'm going to ask each of you, starting with Ken Mason, what does Veterans Day mean to you?
Well, I would say it's a time to honor the men who served in this, you know, in various wars, and just a time to, well, reflect back on all the difficulties our country has had and how we've went to those wars, like the First World War and the Second World War, how we conquered the enemy, and a lot of brave men died. And, you know, it's just a time to reflect.
And let's go next to Jim Moss. Jim, what does Veterans Day mean for you?
Well, today it's a time to recognize all veterans who've served in the military. I'd just like to point out that originally, after World War I, it was called Armistice Day. World War I was a horrible war, and even though the United States wasn't part of it for very long, we lost a lot of good people, including two people from Wausau, the Burns brothers, for which the Burns VFW post is named. And then, so armistice means a truce or a peace, and so this was a recognition of peace, which Americans appreciated. And then 1938, it became a national holiday, and then I think it was 1954, President Eisenhower changed the name to Veterans Day. And so today we're recognizing all veterans, Cold War, peacetime, wartime veterans, and recognition that everybody had some experiences in common.
World War I, of course, was a horrible war. It was supposed to be the war to end all wars, and that didn't exactly work out that way, did it?
No, there were some horrible battles lost. Some of the battles would go on and on. They'd lose hundreds of thousands of troops on both sides, and I'm certainly glad I missed out on that. We didn't have anything like that in Vietnam.
Well, Vietnam was rough enough in some battles in some places.
Mm-hmm.
Greg Foy, what does Veterans Day mean for you?
Well, basically, it gives me a chance to honor my fellow veterans. I sort of look at it from the standpoint, I prefer to spend the day honoring those of us who are here. Yes, we have lost a lot of men and women over the decades, but Veterans Day, to me, is the day to honor the people who are still here and walking around and who have done their jobs and have returned home to lives. That's kind of where I'm at on Veterans Day most times.
You're involved with the High Ground Memorial in Neillsville, a very, very busy day today over there.
Generally speaking, we celebrate the Veterans Day on Veterans Day. This year we had the ceremony on Tuesday from the standpoint that our color guards and stuff get so busy on the actual Veterans Day, it's hard to get everybody scheduled. But again, we'll have a full day down there. I wasn't able to make it down there today myself.
Well, we're happy you weren't because it allows you to be here with us. But, Jim Moss, you were involved in and are involved. They're still ongoing, the Veterans Day celebrations in Wausau. Tell us what's going on today.
Yes. Well, I'm chief of staff of the Burns Post, and so I was at the Hangar Lounge, which is our clubhouse on River Drive, and I set up a membership display there, and there was lunch served to the veterans who attended the Veterans Day ceremony up by the courthouse this morning, and then they came in for lunch, and so I was involved with that, and from here I'll go over to River Valley Bank, and the chamber is having some recognition of veterans, and we've got some information over there as well.
And Ken Mason, you were at a ceremony this morning in downtown Wausau.
Yes.
Tell us what you saw, and tell us your impression of, the feelings of the crowd that was on hand.
Well, there wasn't too big of a crowd, but a good crowd, and they had an I don't know the person that gave the speech, but he was very meaningful, and it was a time to honor the veterans.
You know, so many of these holidays that honor our veterans, things like Memorial Day, it often seems like some of these holidays either aren't being observed by the general public, or in the case of Memorial Day, we've kind of turned it into a picnic instead of what its original purpose was. I don't know if any of you would like to comment on that.
Well, that's a good point. The, of course, Memorial Day is to recognize especially deceased veterans, and the timing, like today, it's always at the 11th hour of the 11th day. The majority of people are probably busy with a lot of
right.
other things. So you eliminate a whole lot of people right there. And it isn't a Monday holiday or a weekend holiday this year. So it's right during the work week.
But at least in that sense, it allows you to focus on the purpose of the event.
That's true.
1-800-780-9742. Are you a veteran? Do you know a veteran, a family member, somebody who meant something to you? Do you have a story? We'd like to hear it. Give us a call toll-free at 1-800-780-9742. Let's go to Pete in Plover. Pete, you're on Route 51. Hello, Pete.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks to your veterans you have on there, guys. Thanks for your service. I sure appreciate our veterans and what they've done. And my grandfather served in the Merchant Marine in World War II. So he wasn't holding a rifle, but he did get wounded a landmine incident in a vehicle he was traveling on. But I have nothing but respect for the veterans and the sacrifices they make, but I have some contempt for the politicians who get us involved in some of these wars. And I'm thinking of the Vietnam War, and the Gulf of Tonkin incident has been revealed in recent years to have been a fraud. It didn't happen the way they told us, and that's how Johnson the war. So I have nothing but respect for the troops, but I have I hold the politicians in contempt who send these guys over and to lose their lives and get wounded and have their lives ruined. So I was wondering if you gentlemen could please comment on that. And again, thank you very much for your service to our country.
Well, Pete, thanks so much for the phone call. Jim Moss, you're both a veteran and a politician, so we'll let you take this.
Well, he's got a good point about our politicians, because in many cases our military service people are kind of pawns in the hands of the politicians and the people who influence them. I was kind of before I went to war, I was kind of a hardcore guy in favor of it, going to Vietnam. But years later, when I realized that France had, when they were bottled up in Dien Bien Phu, they asked the United States for some medium-duty bombers to relieve the pressure on the French Foreign Legion over there, and the United States wouldn't give them any. So the French got kicked out, and then the politicians managed to get the United States troops involved, and we learned later that the Gulf of Tonkin incident was a ruse to a false flag situation to get us involved. And so,
but Jim, you fought there nonetheless, and the Vietnam War was a very unpopular war, and a lot of Vietnam veterans weren't exactly welcomed home with open arms by the American public. Do you think we've taken a different view of veterans today, and that the American people have certainly put veterans in higher esteem than they were 40 years ago? And Greg, why don't you respond to that?
Well, I would really like to believe that the Vietnam veterans, through their actions when they came home, have engendered a respect for the soldier, as opposed to what happened to us, separating the policies of the government from the people who are involved in carrying those policies out. The I went through that. I'm sure Jim went through it. When we came back, one of the first things that they told you to do was, if you're coming in and you're going to be in uniform, find some place to change into civvies. Your civilian clothes.
What a terrible message to send to the guys who are fighting overseas.
Yeah. And, I really like to believe that, what we went through and what we've done with that since then has changed the way people think.
Ken Mason, when you served in World War II, there was certainly no ambiguity or no doubts about your mission and no doubts about the support of the people at home. That was a different time.
Well, I think Hitler had done enough, and it was closing in on Britain and bombing Britain. And I think Roosevelt and Churchill just got together, and Roosevelt felt that we should go into the war. And we did. And you just went along with it. And I didn't want to go into the infantry, so I enlisted in the Air Force.
But everyone was behind that one, all across the country.
I would say yes, yep, because of what was happening over there. Hitler was doing some awfully bad things.
Well, Ken, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, I want to talk to you specifically about your World War II experience. Ken Mason, World War II veteran who served in the 8th Air Force Heavy Bombardment Group out of England, Jim Moss and Greg Foy, two Vietnam veterans. Greg also involved with the High Ground Veterans Memorial in Neillsville. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. We're taking your phone calls, your stories, your pledges of support for our fighting men and women at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742.
Support for WPR comes from UMR, a United Healthcare company providing employee benefits administration, integrated health management, and pharmacy benefits administration for self-funded employers throughout the U.S. More at umr.com.
This is Route 51 Regional Talk Radio, a salute to veterans. We have three local veterans with us, and we want you to call in and share the story of somebody who was important to you, somebody that meant something to you who was a veteran, or if you are a veteran, we want you to call and share your story with us. 1-800-780-9742. Ken Mason, tell us a little bit about that medal that you brought with us today.
Well, that's the Distinguished Flying Cross. And that was given to me not so much for what I did, but for completing 31 missions. They gave you the Distinguished Flying Cross.
Now, you saw a lot of action. You were in England, of course, which was the epicenter of the air battle. And you told me that your first mission was on D-Day. Tell us about that.
Well, the night, usually we'd have a briefing, and that particular night I went up to operations where they usually did the briefing, and all the planes were lined up in a row, and I said to myself, something big is happening here, you know, because usually they were in revetments, so a fighter plane couldn't come in and knock off three or four planes in a row. They were scattered, and that particular day they were all lined up, and I knew something big was happening. And of course went to briefing, and that they said, this tomorrow is your first mission, or not your first mission for some. For me, it was my first mission. It was D-Day.
And D-Day, of course, stood for Day-Day, and then there was H-Hour. And tell us your experience in that battle. What were you doing? What did you see? What did you experience?
Well, that particular mission I would call a milk run. A milk run is where you just go out, drop your bombs, and come back, and there's no fighter or anything else. And I thought, you know, I'd seen a lot of pictures in the magazines, and well, D-Day would be German fighters all over. Well, it was nothing like that. We just dropped our bombs on the target that we were given and flew back, and it was an easy mission.
But some of those missions weren't so easy for you a little bit later. You were involved in heavy bombardment of Munich and Berlin.
Well, we went to Berlin, and that was called the Big B. And that was, of course, a tough fight, a tough mission, because you'd have fighters all the way in and all the way out. But I will say this, that when I first went over there, we had a briefing in Northern Ireland, and this guy that was giving the briefing, he said, well, look to your left and your right. He said, one of you isn't going to make it. And I thought to myself, boy, that's a terrible thing to say, you know. But anyway, it didn't work out that way. I would say that the big thing that happened to the Air Force was when the P-51 was able to fly. They, with wing tanks underneath their wings, gasoline tanks, they were able to fly us all the way to the target and all the way back. And that made a big difference.
You were in a close call on one of those bombing missions.
Well, we were, went to a mission over Munich. Munich was sort of a supply point. The trains would come in there, and then they would feed supplies to northern Italy or southern France. And so it was a tough, you know, the Germans protected it very well. Well, we went in there and dropped our bomb. They were 500-pound bombs. Some went off immediately. Some had delayed action. So to keep the fires going down there, anyway, we lost two engines on the left side of the plane. They were shot out, not functioning at all. And a hole in the gas tank on the right-hand side. And I said to myself, I got to get out of this plane. So I went for my chute to jump out. I said, we're going down. Well, my pilot, I realized that you don't leave a ship or a plane until the pilot tells you to go. And, of course, he didn't tell us to go. He feathered those two engines, cut the gasoline off to the right-hand side. We dropped down, left the formation. We couldn't keep up the formation on two engines. So we dropped down to 1,500 feet. They flew us back to England. We landed at a emergency air base in the south of England. And there were two fire trucks waiting there, but we landed okay and worked out.
Somebody was looking out for you that day.
I guess.
Now, you were in England at the time of the bombardment, the Nazi bombardment of London, and how what's your impression of the English people and how they stood up to all of that, how they persevered?
Well, they just went about their business, and they certainly weren't going to let the Nazis, you know, they weren't going to collapse, so I contacted some of them, would go into London when I'd have a three-day pass. I always go to London because that is a big, big city. And so they, you know, they respected the American soldiers for what they were doing, I'll tell you that, because they would talk to us and do different things for us. And
Do you think America could fight another war like World War II, a huge worldwide war, on two fronts, involving a complete mobilization of the economy, all of the people, the young, the middle-aged, the old, the women working in factories. Could we do that again today, or have we become too selfish and soft to do what you folks did, the Greatest Generation?
I'm sure that we could do it because, you know, if your back is against the wall, you just do your job. And this is a great country, and I love it, and I'm sure that there are many young people that feel the same way and would do their job.
We are talking to Ken Mason, World War II veteran, and we've got a couple of Vietnam veterans with us, Jim Moss and Greg Foy. Greg Foy is also active with the High Ground Memorial, which has meant so much to veterans over so many years in Neillsville. We'd like to hear from you, 1-800-780-9742, 1-800-780-9742. We'll be taking your phone calls right after this news. As we listen to the Andrews Sisters doing Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy, we have our own salute to our local veterans on this Veterans Day. We have a couple of Vietnam veterans, Jim Moss and Greg Foy. Greg is also active with the High Ground Memorial in Neillsville. And Ken Mason, a World War II veteran. Ken, I see you smiling listening to the Andrews Sisters. Is that a tune that you listened to back when you were in the service?
Well, yeah, and I always enjoyed the Andrews Sisters. They did a great job on that song.
Ken Mason, how did serving in World War II change you?
Well, one of the things they did for us, and the best thing they could have ever done, is to let us have a four-year college education. When I came back, I said when I was in my bunk over in England, and they announced that, and I said, boy, I'm going to college when I get back, and I went to the University of Wisconsin.
That was the GI Bill, and Greg, if you could just comment on how important some of these veterans' benefits are to the veterans who are serving not only back in World War II, but today in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, the educational benefits have changed over the years. When Ken came back and when I came back, pretty much our educations were going to be paid for Now it's a contribution and payment program. And it's still very important. If you're a high school graduate, which basically you have to be to get into the military anymore, getting that college degree gives you that leg up in the outside world. When I came back, I got out and I worked for a few years and could pretty well see the handwriting on the wall that I was going to end up being a technician in the back of the factory forever. Mm-hmm. And my wife looked at me and said, well, you've got the GI Bill, when should you use it? So that's when I packed up and went to college.
We also have Veterans Administration hospitals that serve so many vets in the area. And there have been talk in some places of privatizing them in order to help address a budget deficit. And one of the proposals that came out just yesterday for President Obama's budget deficit commission was that we need to make $100 billion in cuts in the defense budget. I'm wondering whether or not you think it would be wise to make those cuts and whether or not it would be wise to privatize something like the VA hospitals.
I'm not entirely sure whether they're going to cut those funds during a period of combat. There are obviously things that could be done. I noticed that they said something about closing a third of our overseas bases. Actually, that could probably work perfectly well. As far as privatizing the VA, not in my watch. I really don't see that as a good thing in any way, shape, or fashion. We're finally getting the VA to the point where it's functioning the way it's supposed to. The veterans who are coming into the VA system who are actually receiving the care that they're supposed to receive. If they start dinking around trying to privatize it, we're going to have some serious problems and guys are going to fall through the cracks just like they used to. And that's not right, and it can't happen.
Jim Moss, you were in Vietnam at the height of the war. Were you drafted or did you volunteer?
I was drafted.
And what were your feelings as you left stateside and headed overseas?
Well, I wasn't happy. I had already finished my college education, but I wasn't employed, and so at first I applied to get into the Navy officer candidate school, and I tested okay, but they wanted to retest my eyes because they were thinking about naval aviation, and I thought about naval aviation for about 2 seconds and figured out that I'd be flying from out in the Gulf of Tonkin. wouldn't be so bad. Landing would be a little bit intimidating.
Landing is always the tough part.
Yes. So I took my chances, and they got me. They drafted me, and of course they figured, well, what should we do with this college graduate? Let's put him in the infantry. So,
what was it like in the 11th Light Infantry Brigade?
Well, I got to my unit, and the sergeant asked me if I could read a map, and of course I'd been in Boy Scouts for many years, and of course I can read a map. He says, okay, you're going to. My unit was actually a heavy mortar unit. And I figured the heavy mortars, this is great, because in infantry they have 81 millimeter mortars, which they have to carry around out in the field. Somebody carries the base plate, somebody carries the bipod, somebody carries the tube, and some people carry ammo. And so I figured, heavy mortars, I'll be on a fire base. Well, I could read a map, so they were going to send me out with the forward observer and call in fire support. So I was attached to a line infantry company, and our area of operation was between the South China Sea and the beginning of the Highlands.
You lost some friends in combat.
Yeah, we ran into North Vietnamese regulars, and this was quite a ways down into South Vietnam. So we were usually around Southern I Corps around Duck Fo, where I was operating, we would occasionally run into Viet Cong, and would be sniped at or take some mortars or something. But the North Vietnamese Army was a whole different ball game. Yeah.
And what happened? You were
Well, maybe it was, in some ways it was kind of lucky, because we were a couple of kilometers out of Duck Fo, and we'd spent the night there, and they flew in hot chow, and the first sergeant always sent us these big canvas mail bags, and they'd throw in some beer in one and some soda in the other one, and a couple of chunks of ice. And but the next day, they didn't pick that up. We'd have to drag it with us until we got resupplied. So I was dragging this heavy canvas wet bag, and I got a little bit behind, and then I was starting to catch up, and that's when we ran into the North Vietnamese. And
so you're saying your friends in front of you ended up getting
right,
killed.
The people in front of me were the artillery forward observer, recon sergeant, and radio operator. So those are the people I hung out with, and so they were a little bit further into the NVA, and those are the casualties on the left flank that I was walking with.
How did that experience change you, and how did the whole experience of serving in Vietnam change you?
Well, in some ways, I'm still figuring that out. I guess in some ways, it has affected how I view death. I don't get real emotional about death, or people who die, or people who are close to me that die. So, I haven't really figured that out. That part is kind of numb. Although if I go to the high ground or the wall in Washington, that affects me differently.
And Greg Foy, a lot of Vietnam veterans had to deal with post-traumatic stress and things like Agent Orange, and a lot of them are still working through those problems.
Oh, absolutely. I've been an active member of Vietnam Veterans of America since 1992, and I've gotten to know a lot of vets. And my time at the high ground, I spent a lot of time with vets, and they are spending a lot of time working through, even years later. And actually, I've gotten to know some World War II veterans down at the high ground who are also working through their issues. They didn't call it PTSD back then, but that's what it is. And all we can do is try to support each other as best we can, and find the help that they need for those that need more than just a shoulder to talk to.
We're talking to Greg Foy of the High Ground Memorial. He's a Vietnam veteran, along with Jim Moss, and World War II veteran Ken Mason. It's Route 51 Regional Talk Radio. I'm Glenn Moberg. It's our salute to local veterans. We'd like to hear from you. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800-780-9742, 1-800-780-9742. We'll be back right after this.
The businesses, professionals, and organizations that support Wisconsin Public Radio's programming play an important part in our financial health. When you visit a WPR sponsor, please let them know that you appreciate their support of the station. Thanks very much.
Hello, Christine. You're on Route 51.
Hello. I'd just like to comment. I am not a veteran. My husband is a Vietnam veteran, and he spent most of his time living in Agent Orange when he was in Vietnam. And his body is riddled from it. He's had a lot of neurologic problems, and he's had some cancer. He did receive some disability payments lately, but now they're trying to take the payments away from him. So I just like to comment on that and like to know what the feelings are of the gentleman on the show about that.
That's boy. Our prayers are with you and your husband, Christine.
He's unable to work because of his disabilities.
any of you want to comment on that?
Well, luckily I missed out on that. Where we were, I did see helicopters flying over our fire base that had looked like they had sprayers attached to them, but luckily we didn't run into it over in our area. But this is just an example of a veteran's entitlement. We call them veteran's entitlement because the veterans are entitled to them because they've earned them. And so if they, as a result of their military service, they are sick or wounded or affected in some way, either physically, emotionally, or financially, then the government needs to provide that. There is no welfare program or a charity program. It's an entitlement.
Mm-hmm. And Greg, do you have any advice for Christine?
I would assume that your husband has been working with the county veteran service officer up there?
Yes, he is.
Okay. That's the primary way to go. Mm-hmm. Other than that, going with some of the veterans organizations, the VFW, American Legion, they also have counsel.
Yeah, the DAV has a good veteran service program, too.
Okay.
Yeah.
Christine, our prayers are with you, and I guess for those who are listening, who are in regular touch with your representatives, maybe it's important for you to tell them that veterans' benefits are important and they shouldn't be cut back.
Yeah, that would be nice because I'm sure we're not alone.
Yeah, the veterans organizations have veterans service officers too, and they have trained people who, if you get denied by the government program, they have knowledgeable people who can figure out how to appeal that.
Okay.
Christine, thanks so much for the phone call, and good luck to the both
much.
Of you.
Thank you for the program tonight.
Thank you. I'm going to play right now a couple of short clips, audio clips, from two veterans, Ken Mason, that were on the Never Forgotten Honor Flight that the two of us went on as well. Now, these two guys are next-door neighbors in Stevens Point, Will Lehner and John Rainier. They're both 89 years old. Will Lehner served in the Pacific. John served in General Patton's Army in the European Theater. And Will's got quite a story. He was on a destroyer outside of Pearl Harbor on the morning of December 7th in 1941.
Once a week, we would go and patrol the entrance to Pearl Harbor. Kind of a tiresome job because we patrolled back and forth between Barber's Point and Diamond Head at about 5 knots. And at 3:30 in the morning of December 7th, we went to General Quarters, which is battle station. They had sighted an object in the water, and I looked out, and I saw this, whatever it was, just the conning tower. And we were probably about 100 yards from it, and the skipper had given orders to fire, and I saw it when it hit the conning tower. The sub rolled over in the water and then righted itself and then started going down, and I was standing on the side of the ship, and I saw the sub go right underneath me.
So you think that it was a direct hit?
Yeah, I saw it when it hit the conning tower, and it rolled over and then righted itself, and then it started going down.
How long was this before the actual attack?
About an hour and 20 minutes.
So nobody put two and two together in time to warn the people on those ships?
Well, we radioed in that we had sunk an unidentified submarine on the surface at the entrance to Pearl Harbor, but some way or other it never got to the big boys, and nothing happened. And then about 8 o'clock, a couple of planes came over us, and they were so low that you could see the pilots in them, and they dropped a bomb on each side of us and lifted the ship out of the water a little bit, and we could see the red ball on them. Well, right away, then we knew what was going on, that we must be at war now. And I didn't see the effect of it until we went in about 1 o'clock in the afternoon for more depth charges.
And what did you see at that
and
time?
Then we saw the ships were burning, the oil was burning on the water. There were bodies in the water, and we didn't realize at the time when we were at the entrance, we didn't realize how bad it was until then.
Ken Mason, quite a story. And can you imagine if the word of that Japanese submarine had made it in to Pearl Harbor an hour and 20 minutes before the Japanese attack, how history might have been changed, how many lives might have been saved?
I was home at the time. It was a Sunday morning, and I was coming downstairs. I slept upstairs, and I was coming down, and my folks said that Pearl Harbor has been bombed, and things happened fast after that. It was, but they couldn't have done anything more to electrify the whole country than to do that, a sneak attack.
And Will Lehner later went back to Pearl Harbor with a National Geographic expedition, and they verified his story. They found the remains of the sub outside of Pearl Harbor. Now, he is a next-door neighbor with this man, John Rainier, who served in an Army field hospital with General Patton's Army behind enemy lines in France and then in Germany.
There were 8 operating tables going 24 hours a day during the heaviest fighting. There were several weeks that there was extreme number of American casualties in the heavy fighting for to take over the old Maginot Line fort area.
What kind of operations went on in these MASH units?
Well, everything from simple cleanup of superficial bullet wounds to serious brain surgery, brain injuries, spinal injuries. This was when I first learned about the SS part of the German military. I was happened to be in one of the operating rooms when a young 22-year-old SS officer, he was had his right arm blown off just below the shoulder, had had little or no medical attention. He was quite badly infected, and he was in extremely bad shape, but still conscious. He was brought in to put on one of the operating tables. The surgeon and his technician came and took a look at the corpsman's notes from the ambulance, and the surgeon told his support person, he said, if we have any chance of saving this guy, he's going to need whole blood and need it fast. Whole blood was used only in the near-death cases. This young German feebly raised his left arm and said, what kind of blood is it going to be? The surgeon said, well, what's the problem? It'll be the right type of blood. And he said, if it's Jew or Negro blood, I don't want it. This was a shocking statement from a person near death. The surgeon put the sheet over him. He said, take this man off the table. There are men waiting that want to live more than he does. So they took this man out of the operating room. I never knew what happened, but I assume he died that night.
John Rainier of Stevens Point at an Army field hospital in General Patton's Army in World War II. What a story, huh?
Yep.
What a story. You know, we've lost a lot in this country. We've lost a lot of our manufacturing base, the factories that used to turn out the tanks and the aircraft and the munitions. And does that worry you that maybe we won't be prepared in the future for battle if we're importing so many of our manufactured goods and we no longer make steel products in this country?
That concerns me. What concerns me more is that I'd like to get back to the idea of Armistice Day, where we recognize peace, and I'm concerned about the failure of government diplomacy, intelligence, and that sort of thing, getting us into situations where we need the military to fix things rather than our diplomats.
Greg Foy, any final words for us?
Well, I suppose I'll throw in a plug for the High Ground. All veterans are welcome. Their families, friends, anyone. We'd love to have them come down and visit us.
And Ken Mason, thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, it's been a pleasure here to tell a little bit of our stories, and I appreciate your calling us in here.
Thanks to Jim Moss, Greg Foy, and Ken Mason. Thanks also to World War II veterans Will Lehner and John Rainier, both of Stevens Point, whose comments were recorded at Central Wisconsin Airport in Mosinee prior to the October Never Forgotten Honor Flight. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, our on-air producer, Jane Ritger. Special music today by the Andrews Sisters, Creedence Clearwater Revival, and Ray Charles. Next Thursday at 5 on Route 51, an amazing story of survival and Thanksgiving as we welcome author, logger, backwoodsman, and philosopher Gary Ettinger, a Price County man who has written his life story, Will to Live, a saga of survival. That's it for us. Thanks for riding along with us today. Thank a veteran for us. Until next week, we're heading out of town.